not a full year yet, but we hadn't needed, you know, that's telling. We moved here in July and nobody had needed a doctor. My son was seeing a therapist and he was still medical. He was still, meeting with his therapist and psychiatrist in Northern Virginia because they were doing it all, you know, I forgot what that was called, teledoc. They were doing it all not teledoc, but which would not have happened without the pandemic. If the pandemic hadn't happened, he would not have been able to stay with him. He would have had to find somebody right away. So that was delayed. So he was the only one who was seeing a medical professional. Oh, my husband or I didn't need one. And then I think he actually signed up for his annual or made an appointment in order to get the vaccine. So his annual was like March of 2021 and he was in something. I can't remember exactly, but he was of an age where it was like, okay, he was immediate. Well, when I found out that, I was like, oh, then I'm getting my annual and see it. Like, I'll beg. I don't care. Cause I wasn't old enough, but when I went in, like my weight was like, I got the lovely COVID weight and he was like, okay, you can get it. I'm like, yay, the weight was worth it. So yeah, it was really effortless. He got me signed up. You know, Houston Methodist had like a whole kind of vaccine clinic that, you know, it was very organized. It was really, really easy to access. My shot was maybe 3 weeks after my annual. But it was this incredibly like kept us separated and, you know, got everyone through and masked and it was just this effortless process. Then the second vaccine, again, because it was also interconnected, they do my chart, you know, we're getting notifications like you're eligible and get your booster, you know, so it's been super effortless. I think my booster I did at the Houston Methodist Clinic as well, but then I got my last booster, my second booster, and that was just through CVS. So, but again, it's all my information is all in my chart. It's super easy to bring up. My vaccine card is there too. Like, so it's been a really effortless for me and my husband to access. And then my son could go through it that way, but Rice University has been, you know, so, you know, everything that we, you know, it has been great. You know, and again, it's the notifications. They were testing through, when did they finally stop testing? I guess last spring. But they were testing for a long time. You'd go in once a week, get the test, you'd get tested, find his results. But the vaccines and the boosters, they've just come in, get it done. And it's been a really, really seamless process. So fortunately for us, it's been effortless to get the vaccine. But we were proactive too about like, okay, if it's available, we're going to go get it instantly. And the thought process was like, again, like I'm not going to argue with a virus. Why would I do that? It makes no sense. And it feels so obvious. Like why? I mean, it's one thing like to look up for my fellow man. Going to die. You know, there were a lot of people who didn't fit the, you know, elderly and ill people who died. I don't want to die. The idea that people are not looking out for their own self-interest. Like, it's okay to be selfish about this. I don't want to die. If that's purely the reason to go get a vaccine, go for it. We were at a bar last night. My husband and I went for a happy hour. And we were chatting with the bartender, and the bartender was talking about a customer who'd come in, and he asked the customer, like, last time you were in here, you were with this really cute girl. And the guy was like, yeah, she didn't want to go on another date with me when she found out I wasn't vaccinated. And the bartender, who he said, like, I shake this guy's hand all the time. The bartender was like, oh, you're not, you know, you're not vaccinated. I'm wiping my hand on my shirt. You're not vaccinated. And I was like, you know what? If the, you know, and as a romance writer, I'm like, if the motivation is I will not have sex with you unless you get vaccinated, go for it. Like whatever motivation you need and whatever societal pressure, like cheers to her. I'll buy her a drink. But for me, it's like, I don't want to die. Like, and I'm not going to argue with the virus. So, and again, like for my whole family, it was really effortless. My 19-year-old, because he was in Chicago, it was like something he was going to get to eventually. And so eventually, whenever he was with me or I was with him, I was like, let's go. So a lot of it has been seen to by me because he's 19 and his head's firmly up his butt, but not because he doesn't believe that it's necessary. It's just, you know, you're going to live forever when you're 19. So, well, not, he's not anymore. He's 21 now, but, yeah, but again, it was just so obvious, you know, and I do know people who got really sick with the vaccine. None of us did. None of us felt bad at all for the vaccines or the boosters. So we're really fortunate. I don't think the baby did either, but the three of us, you know, had no side effects. But it was just, you want to give me something that's going to make sure I don't die and it's going to let me go out in the world. And if I, you know, whatever, don't need a mask, I don't have to wear one, I'll sign me up. Great. You know, it was just such a non-starter, you know, and again, it's like putting on a seatbelt anymore or putting on a, helmet if I was going to ride a motorcycle, which I don't, any of those things that I just do because I care about being alive the next day. It's so effortless.
Would you share a bit about the physical experience when you caught COVID?
God, I felt 100% fine. Is this right? Yeah, I felt 100% fine the night before. I felt super fine when I woke up. It was a Saturday. I woke up that Saturday at like 10 in the morning. I sneezed like 3 or 4 times in a row, which I just don't do. And I was sitting on the couch, so it wasn't like I was cleaning or, you know, and I sneezed hard like 3 or 4 times. My husband was at one end of the couch. I was at the other reading. I sneezed really hard. And I go, and it was like loud and hard. And I just look at him like, uh-oh. By noon, so like in 2 hours, I was 100% sure I had COVID. I felt horrible. And all my sinuses were inflamed. And so we'd gotten a bunch of the post office, the tests you get from signing the post office. So a bunch of free tests. I immediately grabbed one, but I was just like, you know, and so I swabbed. And so I'm trying to think of exactly what my symptoms were then. I think it was just all in my sinuses. You know, it's hard to remember. I think it was all in my sinuses. And so swabbed. And it was like, you know, they tell you not to look for a certain, but it was like brown, hard line in like 2 minutes. I had COVID so hard. And so immediately, this is my office, but it's also our guest bedroom. We have a 3-bedroom place. So I immediately came up here and just got like flu medicine, water, you know, what, and just immediately came here and closed the door. And so what I had, it ended up being about 5 or 6 days of true like illness. I did have a fever, but low grade, super sinusy. It wasn't really in, I never got a cough, and it was whatever that summertime was. So a lot, I didn't get a cough. I did have somewhat of a sore throat, but not awful, but lots of drainage and just wiped out beyond wiped out, just completely no energy for anything. I stayed up here. I was like talking to people, you know, and they were like, stay hydrated. So when I think finally, like on the 3rd or 4th day, because I'm thinking, I don't want to do, I'm just going to write this out. 3rd or 4th day, I finally called my doctor because I just was sick enough. And I said, I just thought it'd be a good idea to connect with you just to make sure there's any, you know, does this all sound normal for COVID and should I be doing anything else? And he was like, yeah, you're doing everything right. Stay on the flu medicine, take zinc, vitamin C and D, and stay super hydrated. So I went, I remember I bought a bunch of, he was like, you have to stay hydrated, so take electrolytes. So I bought a ton of like Gatorade and just did that. And it did. I mean, by day 6, and it was so funny because the same way that COVID came on that Saturday morning from like healthy to fully sick in 4 hours was how it left. It was Thursday night, I remember. Because Thursday I woke up thinking like, I'm the tiniest bit better, but like not better. And by Thursday evening, it wasn't that I was all better, but like by Thursday at 6, I was like, something's happening. And by Thursday at 10, I was like, I feel exhausted, but I didn't really have any symptoms anymore. But it was another at least 5 or 6 days of just exhaustion. Like I really, it was 2 weeks. It was 2 solid weeks of not being able to do it. And trying, like actively trying, when I got better, trying to like get some work done or whatever, I had the attention span of about 20 minutes and then I had to lay down or sleep or do nothing for 2 hours. Like I just had no energy. So it was exactly on the two. So I stayed isolated. When I went downstairs, I wore a mask. When they were in the same floor with me, they wore masks. By like day 12, I was like, can I come hang out with you? I was so bored and lonely. Like an introvert can only be an introvert for so long. So like I sat on one end of the room and they were at the other. But it was 2 weeks in. My son and my husband and a friend of theirs went to a bar. He's like, my son's 24. And 2 days later, my son came down with it. So I was like, it wasn't me. I did not give this to you. And so he had it way worse. He had really high fever and super, super sore throat. And we checked him again with the doctor. He's like, it's fine. He's doing well. Same course of action, about the same time off. And luckily, beginning of summer break and before he had a job. So the timing was ideal in terms of, it was actually right before his job started. And then my husband never got it. And we were good in terms of like isolating, but not like, I'm astonished. I cannot understand how he's never gotten it. Because not only that, we just don't do that much apart. So when I contacted, it might have been at a meetup where my husband wasn't, but I don't think it was. And we were like making out over that time. So I'm like, and then when my son got it, they were at the same bar. Like, so something's going on with my husband. I don't know what, but yeah. Yeah, sucked is what it was.
2020 had so much going on that wasn't just the pandemic, as mm-hmm. did 2021. So does 2022. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, other than COVID-19, what have been some of the other issues on your mind and heart over the last couple of years?
Yeah, my the police, kind of the nakedness of police killing Black people, which, you know, privilege to have either not known or ignored for so long, and for this community to finally say that no more, we're not going to be silent and kind about this anymore. The Black Lives Matter movement was so, again, you know, I'm a good lapsed Catholic. And this idea, I grew up with the idea that the people who were in power were supposed to be there. And it's definitely foolishness on my part, but how broken our system is and how that was exposed and how little has changed in the 2 years since Black Lives Matter happened. I mean, I fully advocate for taking services, taking money away from, you know, gun and club police and putting that into services that can prevent people who are, you know, or who are falling into the system, prevent that from happening. You know, the idea that, you know, they take away abortion rights and then they don't augment that with, okay, well then let's put more services into childcare, into early childhood education, and into resources for all of these women who are supposed to have children that they don't want. You know, the complete lack of balance and the complete inhumanity about that. Again, there's a level of I mean, there's numbness, but there's also this sense of like, I can spend a lot of time on Twitter. or I can vote and I can be active and I can donate and I can talk to people. And, you know, I can put my energies towards actually to doing something that actually changes the system. Even though what I'm doing is moderate at best. My husband's job was that, you know, they're a global company that have a lot of young people who got in his business to make change, and the Black Lives Movement hit them hard and hit them. You know, these are young people who in summer of 2020 were super young professionals. A lot of them don't have partners. A lot of them don't have roommates. A lot of them were living in small apartments in urban areas because it's all they could afford, totally isolated, dealing with, you know, not only this isolation, this loneliness, but then this, you know, injustice that was happening and having to deal with that on their own. And then, you know, a company trying to respond to it in a way that it's like they felt ill-equipped to respond to it. And a lot of like trying to have these conversations that nobody's been prepared to have. And it was a growing time for my husband's company. I think they got through it well, as well as it could be. But it's been amazing. My husband's a white man from the Midwest, and it has been, you know, neither of us are activists. Again, we're kind of good middle-class Gen Xers. But to watch him really try to figure out how to put true concern into action and how to be a real ally without making himself the expert or making himself the person who should be focused on. You know, it's been a really fascinating journey to watch him watch. My journey's probably been both quieter and louder because it's been in the books I write, you know, that I'm writing, trying to write these stories about brown people being seen and noticed and loved. And so it's a different kind of activism, but I think the Black Lives Matter movement has been the one that's been most active and most talked about in our household. That being said, so much has happened that right now, and you know, it's one of those things that I almost have to step away and bullet point the conversations and the things. I think I'm in COVID brain. The idea that if my son gets a girlfriend here in Texas and she gets pregnant and they don't want to have that kid, that us helping them not have that child, we could get arrested. I can't even functionally put my head around that. I mean, that it's beyond. It makes me speechless, and I obviously have a lot of words. that day they overturned Roe v. Wade, we just took the day off. We just took the day off, and my husband just followed my lead. We went to this bistro where they have French fries and champagne. I was like, I'm going to drink friendship, champagne and French fries, and that's about what I've got to offer the world right now. Feeling so hurt, you know, feeling so worthless. But it's like, I said all of that, like things, you know, there's so much that's happened that you have a hard time even putting your arms around it. We changed, you know, I can say we've changed so much. Other people will say we haven't changed. You're just seeing it now and you're forced to confront it. And I 100% empathize with that, like, but I'm forced to confront it now, and it sucks. And again, as a mom, I feel really bad. I feel really bad about what I've delivered up to my kids. So I think those are the two big ones. You know, I guess one at the beginning and one not at the end, but one at a you know, closer to the time now are the two. But there's been so much. I mean, there's just been so much.
What has motherhood meant to you?
Oh, God. Oh, my God. Just in general or during COVID or?
Yes, both and.
Yeah. God. I mean, it's, you know, it's. I mean, it's defined me. It really, and I didn't think I was going to be that person. We, both of our kids were a fun surprise. I was with my husband 4 years and we got pregnant and we made a decision, you know, obviously I 100% would have said, we're, I'm not ready to have a family or have a child. We would have done that. And my husband said, I'm not ready to have a family or a child. We would have done that. One with no guilt, no, that's, you know, but we decided, okay, yeah. This weirdly, it's not exactly what, but yeah, this feels right. Let's, and we were in a situation, we were both college graduates. He was, you know, both of us were doing well in our careers. We, you know, it wasn't a very long before we looked at what could we do it on his salary? And we could. And I was like, I can freelance, you know, but my parents were divorced. I didn't want to put my kids in daycare because I just hated it. I wanted a different experience for my children than I had. And we are, you know, blessed and privileged that our little low income families and our, bachelor's degrees turned into something where my husband could had a job that could support a family. And so, so both kids were surprised. So I wasn't the person who was, and we weren't married yet. I never fantasized about weddings. I never fantasized about motherhood. I wanted to be a writer. I had always wanted to be a fiction writer, but first at that point I was a newspaper journalist. So I wanted to be a great newspaper journalist. So it was unexpected. And so I had my son, but I was staying home with my son and I was freelancing. And those fed me. If we had decided we were going to have a family, then those children were a priority. And the part of that priority was our relationship that I was not going to put my kids through divorce. I wasn't, you know, so I would say less about motherhood and my children being focused and the family being a focus. This is the thing we said we were going to do. We brought two people in the world who didn't have to be there. You know, it wasn't their choice. So if this is the thing we were going to do, I was going to do it too. We were going to have something that fed them and nurtured them and nurtured all of us. And be the people that, I don't know, hopefully gave something good back. And so it 100% made me a better person. And then my son, my oldest grew, you know, was an early reader, was this child recognized just it's not that he's smart, it's that knowledge feeds him. You know, he loved reading. He loved science. He loved math. He, from infancy, you know, like he had a cloth book about space that he would look at all the time. This weird, and it's just unique thirst for information and nature and the stars and way beyond me. I was always a creative, and my husband kind of math, but both of us were more on creatives, but recognized early, just a really smart, driven kid, unique, you know, a different kid, but always well-liked, you know, he always traveled in his own lane, and it was a lane that everyone liked, and he started his sophomore year, we were in an incredibly competitive area in Northern Virginia. And my husband and I, we went to the University of Kansas, had bachelor's degrees. For us, holistic happiness is way more important than keeping up with the Joneses. But when you're in an area like Northern Virginia, it doesn't really matter what your family philosophy is. Those kids are absorbing a lot of stuff. They're absorbing things from their schools and their teachers, whatever. And my son did have this big brain that could go far. But with that, he absorbed all of the stress and all of the pressure. And what we didn't realize, but we were able to track later, is he's always had a social anxiety disorder. He always had it, but he was able to manage it in both healthy and unhealthy ways. Unhealthy being distraction. You know, his therapist would say, like, the worst thing that ever happened to him was to have a strong family unit, because some of that self-support he would have built was built by his family. So he went to college and that support went away. Then he didn't have all of the tools to manage it. And again, we hadn't dealt with mental health in our family. So we didn't have the vocabulary. I didn't recognize it. He didn't recognize it. His teachers didn't recognize it. But I just knew, I remember talking to a girlfriend and she was going on and on about how well my son was doing. And I was like, something's wrong. There's something wrong. I don't know what it is, but he's not happy. And it's not just, there's something wrong. And that's all I could, that's what I had. So he gets into Rice University. He gets into all these schools, he gets full rides, he gets into these phenomenal schools. He goes to Rice University. And I'm just like, well, hopefully whatever is wrong will get, you know, will just get taken care of, because his dream's starting to happen. He wants to be a physicist. And he came home, spring break of his freshman year, having dropped off the mat for a couple of weeks, and, you know, Rice was great. They gathered all the horses and, you know, finally he got a diagnosis. Like, it's very intense. And, you know, we'll do whatever you want. But if he wants to step away from school, you know, they have all of these resources around it. And I was like, I just want a healthy kid, you know, I just want a healthy kid, bring him home. And so he came home, and so it was a very long journey for us. But for me, what I learned from having a child with mental health issues was this idea of what parenting is, you know, and especially, I mean, anyone who is engaging with this, like, I have a strong point of view about most things. I have a strong parent point of view about parenting, and yet what I firmly believed was, you know, giving my children the freedom to grow into who they want to be. As long as there was forward momentum in something, you know, but both of my kids are passionate and focused. And I'm really proud of that. But I did have a sense of, this is parenting. This is what it is. And a child comes home, all of that goes out the window of what parenting is. Because this idea that you have this human who just aligns to certain rules and structure, it just doesn't work that way. Especially with mental health, when there's a chemical mental health component that is, you know, my son would have loved it if everything went this very specific, obvious path. That'd be great. Everything he's gone through is not things he wants to go through. And yet, people who have diabetes don't want to go through that either. And for us, it's acknowledging the health issue. It's supporting the health issue, and it's normalizing the health issue, that he has a health issue. And that has been the long journey of that. And for me, this person who thought, his senior year, he was voted most likely to cure cancer. Like, he was that kid. This person who thought, up until about his sophomore year, and my younger son is very successful too, like, I got this. This mothering, I got this mothering thing. I got it. It couldn't have, like, you know, as a storyteller, like, it couldn't have happened to a better person, you know, because I was the person that needed to realize that I don't got all this, and that's okay. You know, mothering has made me, like, so much more kinder and empathetic to kind of the entire human experience. It's probably, at the end of the day, made me a better writer. But it's not something that I would ever tell anyone else they needed to do. But I made a decision to be a mother, and it's been, I mean, I it's been my whole world. It's been everything. You know, it's fundamentally changed me in the best of ways.
What does the word health mean to you?
Oh. I think I have to make so many allowances for imperfect health. That you can do the things you want to do and achieve the things you want to achieve with imperfect health. And so health to me is taking care of all of your imperfections. I mean, it is doing what you can to mitigate your imperfect health. You know, if you, you know, all of the things that we struggle with, take your medicine, you know, go on a walk when you can, give yourself a break when you can't. Don't exacerbate the issue by ignoring it. Don't assume that the solution to your health is an easy fix. That life is long, that there is no reaching the, you know, pinnacle of health, and then you never have to do anything again. But I think it's managing the body and mind that you're given, doing what you can, and that bodies and minds are so many varieties, and doing what you can to take care of them the best way possible, you know, and that's with amazingly that with resources that can be so limited based on your access and your economy and your knowledge and your support. But I think, I mean, to me, health is doing what the best you can, accepting imperfect health.
What are some of the things you'd like for your own health and the health of people around you?
My own health. I am a big proponent of acknowledging the truth. And I think in health, there's so much harm in your own unwillingness to kind of face the facts and other people's unwillingness to face the facts about their own health or your health. And so doing what you can to kind of face, you know, the reality of your situation. Acknowledge the reality of your health situation, and then and respond to it, and give allowances for it. You know, I my dad had adult diabetes. He was diagnosed in his mid-30s. Diabetes is a problem in our family, but it was definitely exacerbated by obesity, and he had all of these backs. I mean, just the last decade of his life was just miserable. And it was a real learning experience for me about what I don't want to have. You know, our whole family has a tendency to diabetes. Our family has a tendency to be overweight. And I am by no means perfect health. But it was such a drain on the people around him. It was a drain on his own hopes for himself. And I want to be writing for a very long time. And this is a job where you sit in a chair and stare at a screen for hours on end. And I have so many stories to tell. And I don't want that to be, you know, curtailed by my health. And I don't want my health to be a burden on my family. And I want, you know, I'm just really seriously in love with my husband. I want to enjoy that for a really long time. So yeah, I mean, I want to be really, and for our son, coming to terms with a mental health disorder that is never going to, you know, go away. It is a mental health disorder, and for us, normalizing it as a health issue. He has a chronic health issue. He had a panic attack this summer for his job. He was teaching. He was working at a camp and had a panic attack the morning before he was supposed to go in for. He'd been at work month and a half, so they knew him. Unfortunately, they would break up the camp, so sometimes he would be teaching a course where it would just be him. Sometimes it would be a group of counselors. And fortunately, this was a course where it was a few counselors. But he had a panic attack, contacted his boss right away and said, I deal with a chronic issue, health issue. Unfortunately, it flared up this morning. And, you know, I will let you know as soon as I know whether I'm going to be able to make it in today. And I don't know if this is language he came up with himself. I don't know if this is, we talk, and just set the tone, we're involved in his mental health, you know, care and in support. And so the conversation of his mental, we actively have this conversation a lot. And so anyway, I don't know whether this language of I have a chronic health is something he came up with as therapist or his own, but it was so brilliant. I mean, it was so like, of course you do. Like, oh my God. She texted right back away perfectly. Thank you so much for letting me know. I hope you're doing okay. Let me know when you know. So it's also the world understanding this conversation and them responding accordingly. And she did it like textbook perfect. Ultimately, he couldn't go in. I drove him to the camp. He tried. He was like, because what we're trying to mitigate is his anxiety turning into a panic attack and having a panic attack in front of other people, which has all of this cascading stuff. And this was kids, you know. So it's whether he thought he could, you know, take something, get over the hump and be able to get in. Ultimately couldn't. And so getting out of the situation that the increasing anxiety is the warning sign you might have a panic attack, managing that before he does. And again, where it's something where it's going to have repercussions. So ultimately decided will not, got home, let her know. In the past, this has happened where he's so self-flagellating, which is an element of the social anxiety disorder, that it causes a sequence of events that there have been times where it's been hard to recover from. He always has, but it's been difficult. This, by that afternoon, he was talking to some friends online. He was organizing a bachelor party and went into work the next day with no problem whatsoever. And all that was said was his boss was like, thanks, you handled it great yesterday. If you flares up again, just let me know. And his coworker said, you know, hope you're feeling okay, glad you're back. And it was just one of those things that I was like, that is the pinnacle. It's not that my son is not going to have social anxiety disorder. It's living with it. Exactly as our society has come to understand living with a health disorder, we haven't gotten there yet with mental health. And so it's accepting the truth of whatever our health condition is and us accepting it and communicating that acceptance and like, this is the things I need to work around my health issues. But it's also the world responding accordingly. Like, okay, because everyone has got some kind of health issue. We're all dealing with it. How do we get the world to respond accordingly and generously as well? And that's what I think is most important in my health. Just with telling the truth and other people accepting that truth. And then like, okay, then how do we work with it?
What does the word safety mean to you?
God, that's a lot. Like, that's definitely my keystone word. I'm a child of divorce, all kinds of fun, like really obvious, you know, child of divorce, child of like 80s, latchkey, you know, you can just watch any kind of after school special like, to get my whole story. There's a lot wrapped up in providing, you know, as a mother, as a parent, providing safety for other people. My relationships, I align with people who make me feel safe, you know, my relationship with my husband, and both my husband and I are from, a certain amount of family trauma, as most people are, but ours really align. And so we both, if somebody comes into our sphere we both trigger the same way if there's an alarm, you know, and again, alarm beam, but just somebody who like, that person does not feel safe. Both of us trigger the same way. Both of us back off the same way. We have a lot in common and we respond to a lot of situations the same way. So, you know, it's lack of chaos. You know, I think safety for me is lack of chaos. It's calm. You know, and I think for me, safety isn't really physical. It's more about state of mind. It's longevity of safety. You know, it's not letting people into my sphere who will bring, you know, chaos over time. It's managing my relationships and my conversations so that there's long-term peace and, yeah, I mean, I think for me, safety is really about lack of chaos. Lack of chaos, predictability is huge part of my safety, predictability. I'm a fan of surprises. I'm a fan of changing things up, but I like discipline. I like predictability. Yeah, I mean, it's funny because as a writer, it's hard to actually put into words, but it's very emotion and sense based, and and it's control. Oh, anyway, I forgot my other keyword: safety and control. Like I'm, you know, that is a trigger point for me. That's not always healthy, but it is about having control over a situation, or that I trust the person who's in control. I'm definitely not a person who wants to control every situation because exhausted. That's exhausting. Zero interest in that. But do I trust the person in control? Then I can just lay back. You, whatever. I do say whatever a lot and I mean it. So yeah. But do I trust the person in control that they are bringing, you know, continuity, predictability, warm sense of things. I've always been a person who, you know, if I don't feel safe, I bounce. I'm absolutely okay going off on my own. And just, I'm done. I'm out. So yeah, safety and control, lack of chaos, predictability.
Some of this has come up in your answers already, so feel free to say, like, I covered that. But I'll ask the question anyway. Under the sort of narrow biomedical framework of safety from the virus, what are some of the things that you've been doing over the last couple of years to keep yourself feeling safer?
Yeah, I mean, initially, well, so we put a house on the market during COVID, like May of 2020. So we were, you know, massive amounts of cleaning fluid. So, you know, they would let us know that they were going to be coming and everything was wiped down daily. So then they would come and we had bought gloves, we'd bought booties, we'd bought wipes, the whole thing, but we'd see whether they used them or not, which is just crazy to me that people hadn't used them because we didn't know back then. And so then it would be making the boys stay outside. We would go in, we would mask up, we would pull stuff on, we'd wipe down every kind of doorknob in the house. And then, okay, we can live in it now. So the house showing process was the worst. Beyond that, you know, and so we were trying to say goodbye to friends too. We were setting up, we had TV tray tables. So we were setting up TV tray tables outside, like literally like 6 feet away, 6 feet away. They would bring their own food and drink. We would have food and drink. I mean, it was the weirdest way to try to say goodbye to 20 years worth of friends. There was a weird, I think I probably made this clear before, but there was more of the emphasis that we can't get COVID over I'm scared of COVID. I was scared of it. We had all of our food delivered. Like, we weren't going to grocery stores. We were having it all delivered. But I'd already had groceries delivered for, like, 10 years. I'd been having groceries delivered since my youngest was born. Because I was just like, I hate going to the grocery store. So there was a lot of things built in. But there was a weird sense. I really enjoyed my family. You know, when my 19-year-old came home, it created tension in the house, but we really had a nice time. We had a big house. We could separate. People could get their things done. I mean, in DC. So even in those initial days, while it was scary, turn off the television and do the things we needed to do. Is it cocktail hour? Let's do cocktail. Let's play a game. We would have blizzards in DC, and I always enjoyed them because we're all just sitting at home and together. So, yeah, I wasn't overwhelmingly petrified because we weren't going anywhere, we weren't doing anything, and we weren't exposing ourselves. We're all healthy and extreme privilege, 100%. Nobody had to have a job out of the house. We were dealing with extreme privilege, then added privilege of genuinely enjoying each other's company. So the safety things was mostly about the house buying. And it was less about being scared than I can't waste the time of having COVID. And again, 100% recognize my privilege and being able to say that. The drive here was a little bit, you know, nerve wracking, especially because my son was sick. But once we got here, once again, it was like, it was beautiful always outside. So we just went outdoors, you know. I wore a mask for a while walking the dog, but then stopped doing that because a lot of people weren't outdoors. And my dad would have been the most susceptible. My dad was gone. So my mom's was only, I see, if I was 47, my mom's 67. My stepdad's 63. My stepmom is 67. The people who would have been most susceptible were gone, and everyone else was healthy and pretty much paying attention to the rules. I didn't lose one family member to COVID. And I got a big, both my Mexican American side and my mom's side, big family. And we didn't lose one family member to COVID. So again, like, very privileged. So yeah, whether I can't really remember firmly how afraid I was, but we were very cautious, but we just weren't innately overexposed, really. It was probably the main reason we weren't overexposed, and it wasn't trying to be together. It wasn't trying to be isolated. It was kind of fun. People are going to listen to this and be like, she's the worst. I hate that woman. But I do acknowledge how fortunate I am.
It's come up a few times, identifying moments of privilege. And I'd just like to invite a moment for you to talk about what's important to you about naming that.
God, it's so important. Both my husband and I are lower middle class incomes. Lower middle class families. I'm the first in my, both of us are the first in our families to graduate from college. Our parents didn't, grandparents didn't. And that's not true. My husband's grandfather did. But parents did not. We did. We both put ourselves through school. I got a $1,000 scholarship every year. We went to the University of Kansas I paid $1,000 a semester. My husband paid $800. We turned these bachelor's degrees in journalism from the University of Kansas into a really amazing lifestyle. So it's very effortless to say, we did that, you know, like we did that. But, and because it's like if we build it on the backs of anything, my husband built it on the fact that, you know, he's white from Kansas City. I built it on the back of having a family that really valued education and just a level of pride. My Mexican family is very proud of what we built as a family. So, but regardless of that, the way my husband and I have navigated our lives to get to this point, that's still privilege. That's still the sense of whether it's just luck, you know, it's still, I feel really lucky. And to not acknowledge that a lot of people don't get that luck would be so unfair of me, you know, and so dismissive of the entire human experience. You know, to a certain extent, my son's journey has affected that. You know, there's a lot of privilege for people who don't deal with mental health for themselves or in their families. And it's recognizing that, recognizing things that it's very easy to take for granted. And so for me, it would be easy to take for granted the luck and privilege of having a partner who I enjoy his company, who we both have the same work ethic, we have the same family ethics, that allowed us to get to a point where when a pandemic happened, we were economically in a good place to have a big house, to make it easy, to not work outside the home, to be able to afford having groceries delivered. All of those ticks were things that would be really easy to take for granted. And how unfair to people who didn't have that luck, who didn't have the choices, who had to work outside of the home, who had to expose themselves and their families, who had to go to the grocery stores, who had to, you know, bring COVID home and have it exposed to, and who lived with people who were susceptible. All of those things that I did not have to deal with, not because I'm so smart and perfect, but because of the sheer luck of how my life worked out. So, I'm also Catholic, so let's not just, like, I'm not just this big open-minded person. I'm also a person rife with, like, karma and superstition and God will get you. So it's like, if I would acknowledge privilege and blessings, I 100% believe that, like, a lightning strike will happen. So let's give credit to my whole, like, how, like, open-minded I am about this. Also a lapsed Catholic, but no, I mean, it's just, I think I've learned a lot from my son's situation and the situation people find themselves in, good or bad. We as Americans, especially, would love to believe that we are all responsible when we've got it good, that we, you know, we're all self-made, but we're not. We are this combination of experiences and things that happen to us and by us and for us. And, you know, on October 13th, this is how I am. And tomorrow something else is going to happen and God only knows where I'll be then. And so I think to constantly, if you're having a good day, to give thanks to the elements for that good day is always a good thing to do. Like it's a good thing to do and it's a good way to keep yourself, I don't know, self-aware and humane and empathetic.
How are you feeling about the immediate future?
Oh, God. Personally, for our family, you know, we're having a good time. I about said semester, so you can see. When you have a child dealing with severe mental health issues, your days go as their days go. You know, I think a lot of our travel is with him. And so he's having a great semester. He's back at Rice. He's, has managed to manage and normalize a lot of things that have been incredibly, have gotten in his way before. And so he's having a good semester. And so we're doing well. Husband's doing well at work. I am a little demoralized about how my book is doing, but it continues to get good reviews and I am trying to come up with a plan about kind of what's next. And so, but I, you know, saying all that, I'm going to get off this call and I've got a short story to work on and I will literally I'll look at that for 30 seconds and that's all I'm going to do for the next 2 hours. I fall into it and I feel really, I love being a writer. I don't know what that's going to look like. And I don't know if other people are going to pay me enough to be a writer, but I really love doing it. So, I'm feeling, yeah, the near future for, you know, inside the walls. I spoke to my son, my 21-year-old in Chicago on, a couple nights ago and he's doing really well. Again, he's some things he's got in the fire are coming together for him. So, you know, I think one thing about motherhood is you're kind of as happy as your least happy child is a common saying. It's very true. So both my children are happy right now. So it allows me freedom to kind of feel more my own stuff and kind of go through my own journey a lot more. You know, but outside of my home, I'm in Texas. I have a incredibly important election coming up. I'm terrified of the results we've done. We've walked with Beto. We've given money to Beto. We're obviously voting for Beto. But I'm really scared. I'm scared about what's going to happen. I'm afraid of the gerrymandering. I'm afraid of how the system's being rigged. Yeah, I have to admit it. I have to manage those emotions because they don't help me write books. They don't help me show up for my family. They don't help me, you know, get up and do the walking and not eating French fries that I need to do. Like, those emotions don't help me reach my goals of health, of a happy family, of my writing. And so I am nervous of the things outside of my house. But I have to manage how much I engage in that information and those emotions because I've got immediate goals to reach, and those fears and things I can't control, don't help me at all. So, yeah.
What are some of your hopes for a longer term future?
Oh God. To make more money in my writing. My son, we're going to start small and gets his bachelor's degree. My youngest baby figures out, he's supporting himself in downtown Chicago. So that is great. It's very nerve wracking for me, but, you know, figures out long-term, gets a little bit of a break about what he's going to be doing long-term. That Beto wins, that there's a pushback, you know, when Kansas voted against the amendment to do away with the, abortion amendment, I'm saying that wrong, but anyway, Kansas voted to essentially maintain abortion in Kansas. I was sobbing. Like, that was a huge, like, hopefully a huge moment. So I'm hoping we can sustain that. I think everything hinges on that. And if the next elections go bad, again, like, I can't even, like, process. If those elections go bad, I just don't know. My husband regularly talks about leaving the country, like moving. So, yeah, I hope that Beto wins. I hope that every election that there's a decent Democrat running, I hope the Democrats win. I hope we don't get Trump back in the White House. It feels like just looking at the absolute apocalyptic versions of how things could go. I hope it doesn't go that way. I hope we don't get the apocalyptic versions of how things could go. And I hope more people buy my romance novels. It's like you can just get bigger and bigger, and then you're like, and I need to make more money writing these books.
What are some of the things that you've been doing to take care of yourself over the last couple of years?
Enjoying too many cocktails, hanging out with my family, going on walks, drinking a lot more water. I did a keto diet for about 3 months, and it really, really worked, but it's kind of an insane thing to do, and I don't find fundamentally sustainable, so I stopped doing that, but now I'm trying to figure out what the things that used to work for me, and that's a problem, it was effortless, pretty effortless, Weight Watchers, the things that used to work for me at 49, and definitely starting, you know, I haven't verified this with a doctor, but I know my cycle, I'm definitely premenopausal. The things aren't working anymore, and I need to figure out what is going to work. So that is the being truthful about my health and needing to address it, that I kind of keep, like, taking one step, and then I get frustrated, and then I stop, and I need to, like, follow through. I do. I talk to my husband a lot, and I lean on him, and he's a great resource for making sure that I don't feel too alone, and I don't feel like I'm taking on too much. One of the great things that happened in the pandemic is he got way more involved in our son's mental health. I mean, it really was falling on me a lot because he was at the office and taking care of other things. And he has really not only stepped in a lot of ways that he hadn't and probably couldn't or wouldn't, I don't know. But he stepped in he's taking much more proactive in our son's being a sport for our son's mental health. He's more involved in the house. He's more involved in cooking. He's more involved as my career has taken off. He's gotten a lot more engaged and it's been great. So he's done a big, just stepping in, and that not only does it in actuality help me, but the value I feel from him valuing me is like hugely caretaking. I joined two women's organizations. I joined a meetup that's women focused, and then I joined a business organization, and that has been really great. I needed women to talk to in real life. I needed I have two dear friends in the DC area, but I needed non-Zoom, seeing the women, other women and being with them, seeing friends. And that has been hugely feeding. I'm a fan of the show Supernatural. It's just this weird, like, the thing I've done to, like, put I always talk about that. I began reading romance novels when I was young, like sixth grade. But in eighth grade, I moved to San Francisco and there were these mean girls. And I knew I couldn't do anything to affect them. I wasn't doing anything wrong. They just didn't like me. And I couldn't change them. All I could do was wait till my freshman year when I would change schools and leave them. And so what I would do is after school on really bad days with them, I would go to the B. Dalton bookstore and buy a romance novel. And I'd go home and I would read it in like one sitting, like 6 hours. And I'd buy a bag of Ruffles potato chips. And my mom would like come to the door. She's like, are you going to come down for dinner? And I'm like, I know. And she'd be like, fine. Because I wouldn't do it very often. But I really, it was those romance novels were the only thing that allowed that pressure of, the injustice, the cruelty, it released it. Because again, I couldn't change it. I couldn't affect it. I couldn't control it. All I could do was get through it. Those romance novels and the intensity of the escapism that they allowed me to get through that. And I really have not struggled with the anxiety I struggle with in my life is really based on my son and not his fault, but some of the scarier times we've gone through. That's where my anxiety, I really did not deal with a lot of anxiety, a million other things, but anxiety was not one of my issues. I do credit romance novels for organically teaching me a level of self-care early on, this idea that escapism and getting my brain to relax is a level of the healthy self-care. And so I realized early on that I can put my stress in kind of pop culture, again, just getting through these rough periods and being able to relax my brain. And so my latest, when my son came home, I adopted, and not intentionally, but I adopted Supernatural, and it's 15 episodes and 300 million, 15 season, 300 million episodes. So it's like lots to do that, but they have these conventions with the stars. And so I will go and like for this exorbitant amount of money, the stars will not kiss you. They will not kiss you. I'm so sorry. They will hug you though. You can pay for photos and they will hug you and they will like put, it's 15 seconds. It's the fastest 15 seconds of your life, but they will engage with you. And it's super fun. And it's really fun to like have a hot actor like smiling at you. Like, and it's just this really wacky, completely not important and valuable way of like just taking care of myself. Like it's really, and you go and it's all of these people and all they're doing is talking about this show. Like it's an alternate universe. And it's really, really lovely. And so I've done two of those in the last 2 years and they've just been, so I'm probably pulling back now because I don't know. I don't know. But anyway, it's been the romance novel, now that my career is romance novels, I don't find any same escapism in them. I find the escapism in writing them, but it's also my job. But Supernatural has become kind of the romance novel of my 40s.
What do you think scholars in the social sciences and humanities, so departments like media studies and sociology and political science, what should we be doing to help us understand the human side of the pandemic?
God. I mean, I think this, these conversations with real people and all the nuances in them, I mean, there is, even when I did an article for, an online magazine called Frolic Magazine, which focuses on the romance industry, romance genre. And I did an article about COVID. We called it our, that books that we wrote and came out during COVID, we were calling them our pandemic babies. So what was it like writing your pandemic baby? And it was, I talked to 8 authors and the diversity of experience was wild. You had people who had never been more productive in their lives. They loved COVID. They loved that time, the pressure of seeing other people and the distractions, all of that was gone. So they just had never been more productive in their lives. To people who, you know, missed, just, they were losing family members. They were under so much stress that their families were under so much stress. They missed multiple deadlines. We had people walking away from the industry during that time. They actually could not. The not only the pandemic and our response to it, but societally what was happening was so overwhelming that they, like, how do you write happily ever after during a time where it seems like the last thing humanly possible right now, you know? And so just the diversity of these 8 authors and their experiences was so wild that I think recording what these people went through, but then it's like, was so divided, and you know, I mean, we're divided globally, but we're definitely divided in the United States. And what's the solution, you know? And it's not that I expect social scientists to figure that out, but what, how do we fix where we are? How do we stop this retraction of, like, human rights and social justice in the United States? And get back to a fair place again. It's just really scary time. I find it to be an intensely scary time. We have these end of days literature that we see playing out in real time. And what do we do about that? You know, what's the solution here? And again, it's part of me thinking that somebody else has, somebody can come up with one. Yeah, but this is definitely the first step. I was talking, you know, I guess maybe it's the diversity of reaction, but it's also what are the commonalities? I mean, maybe that's it. It's figuring out, as diverse as people's reactions are, what are the commonalities? And what can we as a society draw on as those commonalities to kind of come up with ways that we can start building blocks back together again, you know? Yeah.
This is my last question. I'd like you to imagine speaking to a historian in the future, someone far enough away that they have no lived experience of this moment.
Yeah.
What would you tell them cannot be forgotten about right now?
I think it's how insidious the need to align with power is. That it's hard to imagine people behaving against their neighbor, their family, themselves, And yet, if you take a contingent of people who have a venue to be heard, and you have those people say over and over and over again, you want to be like us, and the reason you're not like that, like us, is because of them. And if you align with us against them, maybe you could be like us. And if they say it enough times in the right way with the right venue, you can actually get people to align against their own lives, communities, interests, families, and their neighbor. And it's something that's happened repeatedly throughout history. So this isn't a new thing. But we thought all of our knowledge and our technology and the easy spread of information was going to curtail this, but it actually has made it much easier and much, you know, it's much easier to spread, and it's much easier to kind of isolate and you know, kind of cordon off. But the idea of the idea of power, and if you align with this power, you can actually get people to vote against, you know, to work against their own survival, their own ability to stay alive. And that's, yeah, unfortunately, that's actually not a new lesson. We're just seeing it in a what looks like kind of a new way because of the technology and the information around us.
I want to thank you so much for the generosity of your time and the thoughtfulness and wisdom in your answers. Those are all of the questions I know how to ask at the moment, but I'm wondering if there's anything you'd like to share that my questions haven't made room for. Please take some space and share it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of people in the future listening to this, when you began the previous question, what would you tell a historian? Just that, and not what can't be forgotten, but what would you tell? I'm so sorry. I do think there was a level of complacency when things seem to be going in our direction, our being a society aiming towards social justice and equality. I was complacent. And that's why I feel responsible. I do think to a certain extent, some of us are seeing the fruits of our complacency, and I'm really sorry. And I don't want to end on that sad note, especially as a romance author who's supposed to promise happily ever afters, but I don't. Yeah, I just feel like we're seeing some of the fruits of our complacency. So maybe that's what I would tell future historians. Don't be complacent. If things are going well in your society, embrace them, teach that lesson, stay active, stay involved, stay engaged, stay passionate about it. Don't take it for granted, because I feel we did.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kit. It was lovely.